It is Saturday, October 24th, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. Hello, I'm the Reverend Bonnie Jean Primsch. I guess I'm the rest of humanity. And with me in the studio are real live geeks, including Brian Young, CG artist, iOS developer, and lifelong tinkerer.
Hey, Bonnie.
Hey, Brian. Also, Miles Elam, political junkie and software engineer.
Hello, Bonnie.
I hear he's good with the animals. Also, Lyle Troxell, software engineer, maker, and family man.
Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
Lots to talk about this time. And Miles, I want to start with you. We've been looking at machine learning over the years, and it sounds like there's been another encouraging development.
Well, encouraging depends upon your point of view.
If you're into machine learning, it's an encouraging development.
One of the things that people like to do with large amounts of data is try to make predictions based upon that data. You see patterns that are there, then apply them to the future and be able to make better decisions. Mm-hmm. For example, there was a case where you look at all the data available to a school and you try to figure out just from the data available from the students that are already in the class, which ones and how soon they are going to drop the class. Because that type of data will be very useful to find out how big do you front load the class, do you allow like more people on the waiting list because mm-hmm. people are going to drop, things like that. But what's different about this with regard to reported by MIT News is that there's a set of machines that were analyzing the data and trying to come up with solutions and predictions, and there were groups of humans. And what they found was that of all of these competitions, the three competitions, the predictions made by the machine were accurate or more accurate than the human teams 615 out of 906 times.
So you're saying the machine can figure humans out better than the humans?
More than the average human team.
Oh,
yes.
Average humans. Okay.
Well, I mean, out of 906 teams, so better than 2/3 of humans.
Ooh. Okay, now I'm discouraged again.
Now, the thing is, the humans worked on their stuff for, I don't know, many times it was, months.
They had a good think.
Yeah, they spent a fair amount of time crunching the numbers, playing around with the data sets, tweaking, mm-hmm. P-values.
Time passed, clocks.
And whereas the machine took somewhere between 2 and 12 hours for each of the competition. Each of these competitions.
So that's a bit humbling.
So not only did they get it ridiculously fast, but actually beat human beings in what had normally been a human endeavor, which is human beings trying to figure out which data points are more important than others to try to make that case. It's that thing like Joel Silver's work with regard to elections.
Oh, that kind of predictive algorithmic type stuff.
And that is done very much by human beings. It goes like, these are the data points that I think are most important. I'm going to weigh these more than others. Mm-hmm. Well, computers are actually speeding up in that regard and may start being a more reliable resource than even some of the best people. In fact, the best people may end up just saying like, hey, here are my algorithms that I'm setting up to do my work for
here,
me.
Here, let me push play on this. Now pay me.
Which explains a lot of music out there.
Is this exciting for you, Miles, or do you feel like I soon am going to become obsolete because computers are going to figure out what I do even?
I believe that as a society, we need to deal with the fact that we are going to have much greater output relative to the number of people. And in the past, it's always been the people that have worked harder, that have pushed the envelope, those are the ones that survive and you have to have a job. What happens when the jobs are completely automated? When many of those those day-to-day, like how do you manage a school type of thing.
But this isn't different than any other time in history when technology, you know, changed what we thought of, right? It used to be that you had a lot of people plowing, you had a lot of horses, and then the tractor came around and a lot less horses, right? I mean, every time we change technology, it modifies the world quite a bit. I mean, how is this any different?
You're saying jobs change rather than go away.
Yeah. I mean, imagine all those blacksmiths that lost their job because they weren't shoeing horses anymore, you know? I mean, yeah, it's a problem, and society changed. But when it came down to it, people still had things to do.
Like make guns, for instance.
But see, there's nice. The question. Do you have a society set up so that it does have that flex, as it were, to move to new jobs and the new opportunities or, you know, just something for some area for people to go and gain employment? Or do you get to a point where so many of these jobs are handled automatically and then you leave the safety net behind?
I don't see where a threat occurs right now. Like what you're saying is that the automation process is going to replace so many people that it's going to be what?
Well, they're replacing journalists in
some
cases.
I'm not going to say it's not going to change things, but is it going to be devastating?
I didn't say it was devastating. I was saying that society would need to make adjustments to say, like, if someone used to work what was normally a menial mm-hmm. or a service job or something like that, and you start having things done for you, especially in areas, because we're used to this idea that McDonald's is quite automated, and mm-hmm. we're probably moving in that direction. It's been covered in the news quite often. But what happens if you can describe a scenario and many of the algorithms can be generated for you because they are known quantities? That top level assembly may still require a human being to say, because I want to do this particular right. problem. But what happens when you have so many of the lower end plumbing solved problems?
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to stick around to find out. Everyone keep breathing.
No, I don't mean that it's suddenly a doomsday scenario.
No, I got
mean
it.
In terms of how are we as society going to adapt to that, especially for people who may not adapt as quickly.
And will there's no way to really know unless we stick around and find out. That's what I'm saying.
Well, are we going to decide to
be
more brutal?
We'll have to ask the machines. Apparently they can figure us out better than we can.
Nicely done.
It's silly for us to try and ponder this. Clearly we have superiors we can rely on.
It would be interesting, though, if public policy, like things, bills passed by Congress and stuff like that, were passed through an algorithm to see their efficacy prior to passing.
Yeah. Well, all right. Let's just assume that we'll be allowed to live on the planet along with our superiors for a while. And let's say that we don't want to have to do that in a world where Flash exists. How can we get rid of Flash on
Oh, we're going to jump into the Flash story.
Yeah, we're jumping into the Flash story.
All right, good, good, good.
I, for one, welcome our Flash banning overlords.
So we all remember what Flash is, right? It's the really annoying front page article.
Yeah, nobody likes it anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So Flash, of course, has been was on the forefront of dynamic websites, or websites that could do amazing things. When you went to YouTube, you were actually looking at a Flash app. Mm-hmm. It required a plugin in all browsers. Adobe makes this product, Flash, and there's always been security vulnerabilities. That's been a constant thing with the Flash plugin. Yeah. And the recommendation we normally make is make sure to update your Flash plugins, do this thing.
But now everyone's saying, you know what? Forget Flash.
It's kind of got to go. Adobe releases updates all the time, and most recently they released an update, and right after their major update that everybody had to update, right? Mm-hmm. They said a critical vulnerability has been identified in Adobe Flash Player, the one they just released, and earlier versions for Windows, Macintosh, and Linux. Basically, every Flash plugin that exists anywhere, and this allowed for remote execution of code, which is, as far as vulnerabilities go, the one you don't want. It's
okay.
The worst.
All right.
And so the company said that they hope to release a patch soon.
And meanwhile,
the only thing you could actually do is completely disable it, remove it from your machine. And that's kind of a problem because not everybody knows how to do that. So there are some wonderful resources on how to do just that. And actually, the way I recommend doing it is turning on a control system, a plugin that says, well, Flash wants to load here. And so it displays a little thing that says, Flash wants to load here. And you have to decide if you want to activate it or not. For Safari, it's called Click to Flash. For Firefox, it's called Flash Block. For Chrome, it's called Flash Control. All of these different tools that you can plug in your browser, you can still use Flash where you need to use it. You don't need to use it for YouTube anymore, by the way. Mm-hmm. But you do need to use it for some locations. Sometimes like your bank might need it.
Yeah.
And so you turn it on discreetly. But there's a wonderful article linked up from geekspeak.org from How to Geek, which is a site that does kind of how-tos on how to enable click-to-play plugins in every browser. This is the idea is that you see a plugin wants to go, and you have to decide to turn it on or not. So that whole terminology is called click-to-play.
Okay.
And so I put some links up on geekspeak.org so you can find these resources. And I highly recommend that you use them if you care about your privacy and security on the internet and you're browsing the internet, because Flash is everywhere.
See, that's something that makes me sad. Some banks requiring Flash. This technology that has had security exploit after security exploit after security exploit.
Is used in some of the areas you want your security to be the tightest, right?
Yes. Yeah, I was exactly. So happy to hear. I use Bay Federal, which is a...
it's a credit union.
Credit union in Santa Cruz and all over the place. Very large, actually. And they recently moved away from using Flash as part of their sign-in process, which elated me. And then things broke completely horribly, and I got really upset. But that was mostly because I'm a geek and I tried to do something I shouldn't have done.
Whoops.
In any case, so Flash is less and less important, and it becomes more and more possible to just completely disable it. And by doing this, you're kind of only you're doing what's called a whitelist. You're only turning it on when you want it. Mm-hmm. Specifically, you choose to do it. And that's a great way to run kind of secure problematic or insecure problematic code is by choice directly. So those will all be up at geekspeak.org. And today's show, of course, is the 24th of October.
Right. So you can look it up for laters. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Bonnie.
What's the Cal ECPA and why did Gorman Brown sign it?
And why do we care?
And why do we care? No, this is actually a great thing, but we're going to get into a little bit of alphabet soup here.
Okay.
The Cal ECPA is the California Electronic Communications Privacy Act.
Mm.
Okay, so what this is this is some legislation that was sponsored by the EFF, the ACLU, and the California Newspapers Publishers Association.
But doesn't that have an acronym also?
Yeah, I'm not going to go there.
Okay.
So what this comes down to is these organizations have been looking at our privacy and trying to bring our laws up to what everybody expects them to be these days with modern cell phones and computers and data and
up
everything
to speed.
Flying. Up to speed across the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So we would assume and we would hope that our emails are private. But until recently, until this law has been signed by Governor Brown, there were many loopholes and many reasons to think that they weren't going to be private and that the laws were not protecting our texts and our photo, our photos and even our geographical location. But
for something on the internet, how relevant is it to pass a law in one state?
Ah, yes. Well,
what's that? I mean, what?
Yeah. Of course, the internet being global does pose a problem that way. Luckily, California does tend to be a leader in these kind of laws, and we can hope that these spread wide and far.
I see. It's just our burden is forefront, people.
Well, if you are in California and for some reason you are hoping that your texts are private, mm-hmm. now at least you have a law that's going to back you up on that.
Okay.
It's
great.
Interesting because, of course, if the federal government is eavesdropping without a warrant and California statute says you have to have a warrant, then there is another level of battle that can happen between state and federal.
As we've seen
this.
Before in this state, between laws that the state thinks should be the law of the land and the federal government that thinks otherwise. I mean, sometimes they'll act federally spite of what the state law is.
So Governor Brown signed this. We're like, it's happened.
Yes,
yeah.
it is
awesome.
Now law. And there are some other states that have comparable laws, Maine and Utah, which are not the most populous states of our nation.
Fascinating.
But these laws do exist. They are on the books in at least three states now, and they're hopefully going to spread further.
So therefore, if you've got a phone and the police officer asks for it, can you just say, hey, I'm sorry, because of this, you have to get a warrant to get on my phone? Or is there, you know, that's the question I have, is like, how do you actually put it into practice?
Yeah, so I've been trying to dig up more information about this law, but it's funny. Everything I find it comes back to the EFF, and those details are not that terribly clear.
Well, but we could actually have – who's the reporter on? Have we had them on before? We've had them.
Yeah, let's
Dave
talk to
Mass.
Somebody over
I haven't
at
had
the
Dave,
EFF.
I haven't had Dave on before, but we'll contact and get a little more details on this because it's a fascinating story. And basically they're protecting in this law, they're protecting emails, texts, as well as user geographical location, which is extremely important.
Oh, that's the metadata stuff.
Mm, part of it.
Mm. Okay, fascinating.
So the whole idea is this. You can have some reasonable expectation that this data should be private.
In California.
In California.
How about some other protections, Miles? If I'm the target of a state-sponsored attack, who will look out for me?
Apparently Facebook.
What? Okay, explain more about that.
A lot of people use Facebook. It's a common medium for people to communicate with one another over long distances and in some ways to keep communication semi-private, mm-hmm. between you and just your friends or you and a particular person. And Facebook, because of the scale of the number of people that are on it, billions of accounts that are on this process, there are going to be some people on there that get on the bad side of some governments.
Okay.
And so those governments are going to hire people, hire hackers, to try to get into those accounts, try to get information
for that person.
Either to insert messages into their feed or to just read the feed and see who they're talking to get that social graph. And so if Facebook sees, through a statistical analysis, probably machine learning, sees that a state-sponsored attack is underway on someone's account, it will notify the person that this is probably what's happening and will suggest to them that they turn on two-factor authentication. In other words, using a separate code, usually your phone, mm-hmm. So that when you log in, it pings your phone and says, here, put in this code, and that will authenticate you.
Okay.
And
so that's how they can tell.
Well, they can tell just because of someone trying to break into trying to do a login and password, trying to do some type of distributed denial of service on that, or actually, that's probably the wrong term for it. I'm sure a lot of people are doing distributed denial of service on Facebook,
mm-hmm.
but specifically trying to target an account and coming from a certain set of IP addresses that may be government owned.
Okay. So when that's happening, what does Facebook send you, a little private message? Excuse me, but
It puts a little banner up on the screen. So when you're logging in, it tells you, hey, we've seen some strange activity. It looks like a state-sponsored account. You don't have two-factor authentication. We highly recommend you turn it on so your account can remain secure.
Oh, that's cool.
And so you'll continue to use Facebook.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
That's cool,
though. Why would they want to look out for someone like that? But really, I guess just every customer is really important to them.
Once you get to that size, once you're at that scale,
yeah.
You really do have issues of, let's see, if my security is off of my app, for me, everyday Joe, security is off of my app. Oh, darn. Somebody, loses their, their grocery list.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
With someone on the scale of Facebook and how ubiquitous it is in terms of communication, if someone loses access to their account,
it's kind of a problem.
Yeah, people could be disappeared.
Okay.
When you say disappeared, you mean that it's possible that somebody's using Facebook to privately talk about government problems in the government they're in, talk about something, be putting themselves out there. Mm-hmm. And if that becomes public, they could their location or their belief system could become public.
But the fact that Facebook is built upon the social graph, it means that you can find out an entire network of people that you may consider dissidents.
Yeah, it's kind of scary. So I remember you first started talking about this when you were working at Google, and that was one of the things they talked about so seriously is that you have to keep this information private because if you don't, people can die. And Facebook's at that level as well.
They've reached that, yeah.
And I got to say, I've been using two-factor authentication for a while. Maybe we should take a break and I'll talk about that a little bit in a second.
All right, let's find out more about two-factor verification when we come back on to GeekSpeak. It's GeekSpeak here on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch talking with Brian Miles and Lyle. And Lyle, we were just about to talk about two-factor authentication.
Yes, Miles brought up that Facebook is kind of suggesting two-factor authentication for people that clearly have some security concerns. And their rules and such are interesting on how to do that. But the reason they do two-factor authentications is a much better way of making sure the person that they think it is logging in is the person logging in.
Right.
And quite a few years ago, I turned on two-factor authentication for Google, my major account, if you will, mm-hmm. that I use a lot for basing my identity online. And two-factor authentication basically is you have something like your phone and you run an application on that phone and that has an algorithm and a secret key inside it. And when you log into account that needs two-factor authentication. You put in your username, you put in your password, and then the site says, hey, put in your secret key. You launch the application, and every 30 seconds, a number changes, a six-digit number changes. And during that 30 seconds of that number being valid, you type it into your web page. It can only be used during that window, and therefore, it kind of you had to know your password, and you had to have this device.
Well,
the two-factor part.
That's a one-time pad. That can be used for two-factor authentication, but two-factor authentication just means two different pieces. So
yeah.
The server.
So that's an example of two-factor authentication.
Yeah. In general, like things Google, Twitter, Facebook, in general, how they do two-factor authentication is you log on to the site, and the cell phone number that you've entered into that site will then send you a text with a code, mm-hmm. and you type in that code.
Yeah, that's the what. That's
so they're the ones generating the one-time pad, as opposed to the software on your phone generating the one-time pad, which is what you were discussing.
Now, when you're saying one-time pad, I wouldn't call it a one-time pad. It's a two things.
Are you guys going to out-pedant each other?
But more the point, the whole idea behind that is that you had to know something, your password, and you had to have something, your phone.
Yeah.
So both exactly. those things both do two factors. You have to have your knowledge and something you have.
Yeah.
And there's debates among which is better and all that. And you could actually do three-factor authentication as well. But in any case, I've been doing that for a while. And when you switch phones and when you switch accounts and start dealing with this, you do have a risk point. Because Google will not believe that I'm me unless I have two factors. Mm-hmm. And there's no way for me to get around that. So if I lose my phone completely, I am totally out of luck. But they have a couple backdoor ways of dealing this. One time, they'll actually allow you to print out a one-time pad of like six or so numbers that can be used once. Those are ones they record and keep. Mm-hmm. It's not an algorithm-based one like the phone app that I was describing. Another one is you can have a secondary backup phone, like your spouse's phone, and that's they can text that one, right? So you have to be yourself or your spouse. And when you do that, you actually have to change your password. So things happen drastically when you change it that way. It is risky, and it makes me nervous every time I change.
Yeah, yeah.
And for my work, I change my phone a lot.
Right.
So at the same time, I'm not recommending it to everybody because of the level of complexity you have to be aware of and how to some degree risky it is that you could get locked out of your account.
Yeah, how solid that second piece of authentication has to be.
And that's
be.
Where a lot of larger software companies have stepped in to try to make it simpler. In other words, that they require the two-factor authentication to authenticate a new device trying to. So if you log in with a laptop you've never used before, then it pings your phone. And once you type in with that, do you want to allow this computer to be able to access the account? Yes. And then mm-hmm. you're set for a while. You don't have to deal with that extra complexity each
right.
time.
That's another thing is it kind of helps you extend your access on your machine.
I've gotten emails that said, oh, by the way, from a different computer than we're used to, something just happened.
Mm-hmm.
Are you aware of that? And they don't necessarily require a response, but they're like, you tell us if this was not you.
Right. And do you check that out? Do you take a look at that and make sure that it was you?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's
I mean,
a good
usually,
thing to do.
Because it was me, and I go like, yeah, I know.
Yeah, I know. I did that on
yeah.
purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that if you're very security conscious and you understand that your accounts online are critical, it is really important to do this because losing your password out into the ether is actually a pretty easy thing to have happen. It's easy to have your keystrokes be watched by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It's very likely, like let's say you go to, you're at a hotel and you're leaving the hotel and you want to print your flight itinerary. So you go onto their computer and you log in with your information on their computer. Well, that computer might not be secure. It might have recorded your keystrokes.
Right.
And so when you ever use your password in another location, you kind of have this problem. Brian?
Well, yeah, I'm just thinking about this because Apple went through this whole two-factor authentication when a reporter, Matt Honan, got
all his data erased.
Yeah. He got all his data erased by, and it was really a social engineering hack that got him. Mm-hmm. But two-factor authentication helps with that. But now I get all of these alerts from Apple that I've logged into this or I've logged into that, and I've got so many devices and so many computers that I'm using these accounts on and getting so many alerts. The problem with passwords and the problem with security is that people start ignoring the alerts mm. altogether. So there's a point at which all this just becomes noise again, and you don't listen to the warning signs.
Like all of the Xeroxed signs over the kitchen sink at work telling you that your mother doesn't work here.
Right,
like,
right.
At some point, no one's paying
attention.
You totally
ignore that, yeah. And Brian, I got to say that most likely reasons you see so much of that is you've got a family of four, and you're an iOS developer, right? So you're always logging in new devices, reloading. You just said that your iPad's running iOS 9. You know, like you're constantly on the cutting edge, and so you're going to see a lot more alerts than most people.
Well, my tolerance is a lot higher than most people. So I have this sympathy for those people out there that are just barely able to grasp any of this and just trying to hold on. and I just want to say, don't ignore those notifications. Yeah. You gotta keep an eye out for them. Important. They're there to save you.
Now, what if Facebook wants you to engage in a little two-factor authentication on your phone, but your phone's battery has died because it's running Facebook so much? Then what?
Okay, so this one hits home personally.
Yeah, Brian, you know more about this, right?
Yeah, I know about this because my wife has been dealing with the fact that her phone, which is an iPhone, has been losing battery constantly. Over the last 6 months, it's been a real struggle for her to try to keep her battery lasting through the day. Mm-hmm. And this is not a terribly old phone. It's within the 2 years that your battery is supposed to really maintain its life pretty well. And she's gone through everything. There's a whole plethora of settings you can change in iOS that should reduce the usage on the battery. And she hasn't been able to really make any progress. In fact, when she broke her screen, we even replaced her battery, and we didn't see an improvement in her battery life after the battery was completely replaced.
So then it's not the hardware somehow. It's something running?
Well, yeah. It's not any of the OS level things that you can tweak. And it's not the battery itself, unless we were given a bad battery. But in the news, in just the last couple weeks, has been that Facebook's app has been using more than its share of battery power.
Aha!
So,
I think I know what's going on with my phone.
Well, So in iOS 8, they added the ability to see which apps are using the amount, how much percentage of your battery. And new with iOS 9, they actually give you a peek into how much of that is you using the app and how much of it is the app in the background.
Ooh.
So what we discovered when we started looking into her phone is her phone is 50% battery usage on Facebook. And she hasn't upgraded iOS 9 yet, and I expect when she does, she's going to find that over half of that 50% is actually in background usage.
You'd like to think so, anyway.
You'd like to think so. Well, there's a number of people that have reported this now that iOS 9 allows you to look into it, and Facebook's app seems to be doing some stuff in the background that is aggressive.
Stuff? What is
it
doing?
The operating system is there to make sure that this can't happen, but there are little tricks that Facebook seems to be doing. Some people were thinking they were doing location checking in the background, and there's reason to think that that's not actually what the battery hog is. That can hog a lot of battery, but Facebook doesn't seem to be doing location checking in the background as much as would account for that. There are some people think that they're using some hidden APIs for turning your sound recording on in the background that might be keeping it alive and allowing it to do more in the background than it really should.
That sounds creepy.
Yeah, all of this is a little bit. We're not sure of this.
It's all conjecture at this point.
But what is clear is that the app is using too much power, and Facebook has responded, and they are looking into this. And hopefully, if your phone is not lasting throughout the day, hopefully they are going to fix this, and it'll help out. Or you could always get off Facebook for a little while, too.
Wait, what?
I heard that conversation in your house happening.
Well, now I'm now willing to blame Facebook for the reason that I always seem to exceed my storage every month on my crappy phone plan.
Oh. Did you buy a 16-gig phone?
No, I bought, I think it's 64.
Are you talking storage or are you talking data usage?
Oh, data usage.
Data usage.
Yeah, could be possible it's that it's Facebook usage. For that too. I'm keeping in mind that Facebook announced, we covered on the show, the whole marketing scheme, where ads would start right away, right? Mm-hmm. And they sold that to publishers. To do that, you've got to make sure to download that to the phone. And you want to do that before the user engages with it. So this is the kind of thing that they want to do. They want to go, well, you know, in the next few minutes, if Bonnie does open her phone, we really want to show her this ad and have it have no delay at all. And so to do that, you have to do it in the background.
And when you scroll down the timeline and you see all those videos in your timeline that are playing, but muted, yeah, they still have to download the videos.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kill the app.
By the way, convinced that it was horking all of my data usage.
So the thing you could do is install Paper. If you like Facebook but you want to get rid of this problem, you could remove the main Facebook app and install an app called Paper, which is also by Facebook, and that probably doesn't have such an aggressive load. Additionally, this problem could be in just some of Facebook's test cells, because Facebook is a very test-driven company, which means that they launch stuff on their app and they turn it on, those features only on for some people, and then check usage patterns and then decide what's going to go on for everybody. Mm. So everybody's experience of Facebook could be different than anybody else's experience of Facebook. And maybe she's in the tests that have the battery sucking power.
For 6 long months.
Wow, that's really bad.
That's a long test. Huh. That's muy mal.
It could be something else besides Facebook, right?
Well, that's just it. The OS is reporting that Facebook is literally using half of the battery power in her phone. And I can't wait to get her up to iOS 9 to see how much of that is in the background.
Wait, what does Paper do? Is Paper just like a Facebook, not Facebook?
Yeah, it's like an alternative Facebook app. It's kind of a cool interface. You, instead of seeing the timeline vertical, you kind of seen it back side to side, and you swipe through things, and it's a lot of gestures. You have to know a lot of gestures. But I used it for quite a while.
It acts more like paper.
The idea is there's a lot less buttons. There's a lot more gestures.
Huh. Okay.
It was an experiment, and it's a pretty fun one. I like it, although it's not keeping pace with all of the newest Facebook initiatives.
Which might be okay.
Yes,
yeah, really. Happy.
If they don't turn it off, maybe it doesn't have the aggressive ads in there. I mean, it could be some benefits, definitely.
Mm. Oh, you know what we haven't had for a little while is a drone update. Miles, you got something for us on drones?
Yes.
You have about 3 minutes on drones.
Law enforcement is looking at a point-and-shoot weapon that will stop a drone, but without destroying it. They're not talking about shooting it down with, you know, either a rubber bullet or a real bullet. They're talking about shooting it with a signal that blocks out or overwhelms the receiver to get the commands from whoever the operator is. And therefore, the drone would presumably stop in midair and just hang there.
Gosh, hell, it falls because of lack of battery.
Right.
Right.
Although, presumably, the battery would wind down and it would slowly descend.
Lithium ions work that way, unfortunately. They turn off like that. But a lot of them, when they do have not enough power to run, they will land automatically. So as long as it's not over a freeway.
I do like the thought that you could just make one freeze. Freeze! Pew!
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. It'd be cool if he just aimed a flashlight at it and it stopped.
Yeah. Who is that? Huh?
Yeah.
Like a deer.
Yeah, I reckon.
Right. There are a lot of people who are concerned about drones, and that's where the story I believe you covered last week about regulation of drones.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe not.
Recent.
We didn't cover it yet.
Okay.
We can do it now if you want.
Talking about the regulation of drones just in the way that you would regulate being able to drive a car.
Sure.
It's like you need to have some type of...
We've talked about that in the past, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
You own a drone, you have to register that you are the owner and that mm-hmm. you know how to use it safely. And at the same time, these things are, sometimes up to $2,000 or more.
Mm-hmm. They cost money.
The larger ones are pretty pricey. So
you don't want to get sued for shooting down someone's drone, am I right?
Right. So something that could just simply immobilize it for the moment and keep it from moving and or transmitting data back and forth to its operator while you investigate it, I think is...
You know, this is just an arms war, though, unless you put laws behind it. Because, of course, if you do that, allow that kind of thing to happen, then other people work on hardening the system so it won't happen, right?
To try to listen through the noise, the big blast to hear.
There's ways of doing it, right?
All right. Well, okay. So that's the latest in the drone wars. We're going to find out more about how people are having an effect on things remotely when we return to Geek Speak. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Lyle and Miles and Brian. And Brian, I hear you've got some news about people using their headphones and some voice commands to control a phone like from across the room.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of scary hacks on this show sometimes when we want to make sure people are aware of the security problems out there and make sure that they can be safe when Flash is going to have a zero-day vulnerability.
We like to tell you about them when there's something you can do about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's nice.
So in this case, this is a hack that sounds really scary, but I'm not fascinated by the scariness of this. I'm fascinated by it. Just this is really cool. It's not that big of a danger to anybody, but a French government agency called the ANSSI, they're a information security agency, has...
Totally friendly.
...has done the research, and they have realized that you can actually control somebody's Android or iPhone through Google Voice Google Now or Siri.
Those are features everybody knows about.
You can control somebody's phone through those features from 16 feet away without touching their phone, without getting close. All you have to do is that phone has to have headphones plugged in that have a mic on it. And those are wired up in such a way that they can broadcast a really strong radio signal and make that headphone act as an antenna and transmit the sound right down into the phone and say, hey, Google, or no, is it hey, Siri, or what's Google's version?
I think it's Hey Google.
Okay, Google. Hey Siri or Okay Google. And you can make that phone respond. I'm sorry, everybody out there.
I know. If you've got a phone that has this enabled, we just activated it. Stop saying that.
You know, I've tried this. Nobody's ever activated my phone when I'm driving around the car. No,
Do you use the Hey Siri thing?
Yeah, I've got it. You just did it again.
I was watching your phone. It doesn't
say nothing.
No, but this model has to be plugged in.
You have to push on it or something. Yeah. So who's got that? Who's just got their phone lying around with headphones?
People walk around with their headphones plugged in their phone all the time. And if they've got this feature automatically turned on, like the Motorola Android phone, that it's listening all the time. And you don't have to press a button or anything. And it just listens for that keyword, and it will trigger itself. And if the attacker can actually achieve that, they could make your phone make a phone call to
call 911. I can't get up.
Yeah, or they.
Hey Siri, call 911, like that.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, anybody that activated. Let us know if it did.
Does that actually work?
I have no idea.
We'll find out.
You can
write us at geeks@geekspeak.org.
Just imagine, you can be like 20 feet across the room and broadcast this signal just to control somebody's phone.
Everyone's actually heard this problem emerge. If you have a phone ring near like your radio, mm-hmm. and then you hear an electronic sound on your radio. Yeah, what's happening is the loud AM noise, if you will, that's on the broadcast is being picked up by an amplifier inside your tuner and rebroadcasting. And basically, that's how AM radio works, right? You inject a giant signal of audio, and you pick it up. You decode it and pick it up. And you can do that, I guess, for the microphones that are listening to, or the circuitry that's listening to the microphone on your headphone line can actually be induced remotely like this. And you basically are playing audio on that from across the room. So it's comparable to that line being like one half of a microphone. The diaphragm happens to be fake.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Yeah, and they make all sorts of recommendations to that manufacturers could do to help us out in the future. But
really, make it more possible, you mean?
No. They could add shielding to the wire to reduce this. Or what they could really do is allow us to customize what that key phrase is so that
the hackers in the corner have to hear you activate your phone first, and then they can do it.
Exactly. In your accent.
Right. In your accent. Yes, and your vocal intonation. Well, okay, frankly, this falls a little bit into the category of hacks that, come on, you guys.
Right. Exactly.
It's
Which
fun
is
to
why
know.
It's so cool.
Yeah.
This is the kind of hacking that gives a good name to hacking. This is somebody playing with the technology. And yes, it does.
It's like, hey, you know what? If you turn this upside down on Tuesday and enter these three characters 15 times into the browser, then you can get something inconsequential to happen. Who cares?
It's cool.
I just want to applaud somebody for thinking about this. I mean,
imagine this too. You're sitting in a restaurant and a whole bunch of people are on have Siri and have their earbuds in, and you broadcast the signal and everybody's phone starts reading the weather out loud. I mean, that's funny.
Right. Okay.
Hey Siri, what's the weather? And everybody's phone just starts talking. It's awesome.
All right, that could be some fun chaos. Maybe Improv Everywhere will take it and run with it in some way. Okay, so Miles, you know about a new experiment that can help us determine what the deal is with gravity.
Yes, I know about the experiment. I am not going to pretend that I fully understand it.
Okay. Does it have to do with quantum?
Yes.
Oh, well, then we're both going to be stupid by the time you're done.
Yes.
Okay.
Quantum theory makes
Miles,
you stupid.
Yeah, I love this idea of yours, Miles. You described it a while ago, and now every time someone brings up quantum stuff, I realize that every time I hear more about quantum theory, I get a little stupider.
Yes, you learn Newtonian physics. Mm-hmm. You know, mass equals force times acceleration.
Totally makes sense.
Yeah, it totally makes sense.
Ellipses, baby. It's all about ellipses.
Yeah, then you get really, really small, and you find out that Newtonian physics doesn't work anymore.
And your intuition is wrong.
Right. Right, and in fact, normally, when you learn new information, mm-hmm. if you were wrong about it, if you had some false
understanding,
you threw out that information and you replaced it with something newer, more robust.
You feel good.
Yes. And allowed you to build upon that knowledge and get something greater than what you had before.
However,
with quantum theory, it takes away everything that you knew. In other words, it says Newtonian physics. Yeah, that's wrong. It's a good approximation, but it's wrong.
Mm-hmm. And it just leaves you a little nauseous.
But
am I right?
It tells you things that you're just like, wait, that isn't what? like, for example, there's something called a double slit experiment.
Oh, yeah.
A double slit experiment?
Yes. Okay. You have this little slit and you're firing electrons
Pew.
Through there. And there is a 50% chance that could go through one slit, 50% chance to go through another slit. You do this with polarization of light as well. And it's really cool because it's not like the electrons go through one half of the slits or the, you know, one slit or the other. The electron starts to interact with itself. It is measurably interacting as though the electron went through both slits simultaneously.
Unless you
have
a detector on one of the slits, and then if you know it went through one, it doesn't do that anymore.
Oh, like if you observe it, it changes the behavior?
Right, but it interacts with itself when it goes through the slits. So it's like one electron became two electrons, but when it goes to the other side and hits the wall, there's only one.
You know why that happens? Because you're stupid. Because what you think you know, you don't.
You don't know.
Now, this is all fine. There's the standard model. There's the quantum physics that we work with. And like, okay, well, we have the wave function. We have the particle functions.
Okay.
You know, these two sets of equations. And we can find the answer through both of them. But unfortunately, those answers, when you really start digging into it, because the wave function will be useful in some scenarios and the particle function will be useful in other scenarios. But there's many scenarios where if you use both of them, they don't come up with the same answer.
Mm-hmm. So,
in other words, it's not so much that we have a hole in our knowledge. We know it's wrong.
You mean we're proceeding with Newtonian physics in spite of the evidence?
No, it's not that. It's you're dealing with quantum physics, which has two methods of finding this information.
Finding truth.
But they conflict. They can't both.
What is
they can't
with gravity,
both,
dude?
Yeah.
So
where's
gravity,
this going?
Gravity is this elephant in the room of like, wait, how does gravity work with these things? Because how would that work with if you have two electrons that were actually one electron? Does gravity double? Is it half the gravity in one side? Does
if
gravity
we think about
go,
it too hard? Are we all just going to start floating?
Does gravity
the more
extend
you think
into the quantum world? And the thing is, we're talking about electrons. How much gravity does an electron have?
Not very much.
So you've had theorists like Freeman Dyson say, it doesn't matter. You know, it really doesn't matter. Like, so some theoretical physicists have discovered a way to test quantum gravity. The trick to it is you have to get something large enough that you can measure the effects of gravity, but small enough that quantum effects will still take hold.
Like what?
Like what thing?
Like a small molecule of gold?
Remember when I talked about how I knew about the experiment, but I didn't know how it was done?
So the punchline is, and I don't know what happened,
is
anyway,
go to the website,
more.
Click on the link, and read more about it yourself. And if you are a physicist with a PhD and you understand this and can explain it,
please contact us.
Contact us and help us be less stupid.
Okay,
so they have a proof.
That shows that
no,
gravity
no, no.
is...
They have a way to actually conduct the experiment. They haven't done the experiment yet.
Oh, my God.
Why is this news? Why did we
because
talk about
this? Because
they
didn't think that it was possible to have the experiment. They now have
so
something that is workable.
Theoretically, there's a way to test to see if gravity acts in a quanta way.
Yes.
Way. Wow, really cool.
Which could then lead to new physics. In other words, seeing where we were wrong and new areas where we can find out where an answer might be that would create a universal, cohesive standard model of physics, which we do not have today.
Well, it sounds like even if it is all just quantum physics, we still won't have a unified system. That stuff sounds weird, man.
Quantum physics makes you stupid.
I won't make any comments about Miles's news stories.
I need to hear some good news, like, I don't know, that like a megalith of technology is somehow infallible in some way or something.
Okay, how about Apple losing a patent lawsuit?
What?
Yeah. So Apple, we've had a lot of stories about patent trolls attacking corporations. There's a whole impact to podcasting where there was a patent troll who was attacking people on their patent and basically taking money from people because it was cheaper to pay them than not. Mm-hmm. That was won and beat, and we won that one. But it happens all the time. Well, this is a story where a company gets sued, but the troll is not a troll. It's not a patent troll because it's a research center. In fact, it's the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And so a large company, a large research university mm-hmm. has a patent, and they took actually Intel to court over this patent. And this patent, roughly, I won't go into the details of it, but basically it's allowing a processor to step down its performance level, putting in kind of a power-saving mode but still be operable.
Okay.
And surprise, surprise, everybody's doing this. And
yeah,
Apple,
it sounds useful.
Yeah, Apple very, very much is using this. They use this in the iPhone 4, the 5, the 5S, the 6, the 6S. Sorry, 6, 6 Plus, and also the 6, 6S. So, mm-hmm. And recently a court said, yeah, you know what, Madison? Yeah. Yeah, Apple owes you. They owe you $862 million.
Monies.
Well, I should say the first step of this is that Apple looks guilty on the situation. They're going to go to court. They're going to fully investigate it. And there's three different phases to this. One of them is whether they're liable, if you will. Apple tried to dismiss it. It's not dismissed. It's going to go forward. And Apple's probably going to pay a lot for this.
Why isn't it over?
Well, because they've got multiple phases in the court, and
they're
basically Apple is just
like
trying to
appeals and stuff.
Yeah, Apple is trying to dismiss it the same way Intel dismissed it. Mm-hmm. Actually, Apple is showing that no, we have the right to this patent. This patent is already kind of dealt with, and the court looked at it and said no, it's not dealt with. This mm-hmm. patent's real. You do have to address it, and the claims that University of Wisconsin-Madison is actually claiming is totally within the ballpark of the kind of owes that Apple might have. So they're going to find out detailed if what kind of whether they infringe on the patent, which mm-hmm. hasn't been actually addressed yet. Uh-huh. And then they're also going to find out how much Apple should pay. And then they're going to find out in this court case, the third stage of this is whether Apple did this knowingly, and whether they knew the patent existed, they knew that they were infringing, and they did it anyway, which means they might toll more fees.
That would be a lot more fees, I would think. And the loss of some lawyer's job, I imagine.
Assuming some
somebody
people
did not
job.
Keep track of their stuff.
Yeah, and this has to do with the processors, the A7, A8, and A8X processors. And this lawsuit is prior to the 6 and 6 Plus, the new phones from Apple.
Right.
And the new phones have new chips, and therefore that would be a new lawsuit. So
Ooh.
It might be a double whammy against Apple. Now, I actually am not a big fan of patents. I think the patent system is pretty broken in this country. And it's concerning to me, but at least this is a case where there's an educational facility who potentially could reap the benefits of their research. And to me, that's one of the reasons why we have patents, right? We want people investing in pure research.
Well, okay, so it sounds like you don't disagree with the idea of what the patent system is supposed to do.
Right.
You just disagree and disapprove of how it is currently playing out because it is broken.
Right. Some problems with it is this idea of obvious mm-hmm. is really hard to pin down mm-hmm. in a society where everyone's learning. Like the knowledge that we have now compared to when I was in school is vastly different. Mm-hmm. And therefore, at some point, people had to invent new things and new ways of thinking. Within every 20 days, people think of new ways of thinking. And then they base their new knowledge off of that new ways of thinking.
Right.
So to say that I thought of something no one else thought of, everyone does that all the time. It's not because you did something unique. It's because of the world that we live in.
That's how we think. That's
yeah.
what we're saying.
I mean, you could talk to anybody and they have an app idea on their phone, right? Mm-hmm. And any kind of idea, if it hasn't been done before, clearly could be patentable, right? But we have these new ideas because we have new toys. And that's just how the human experience is.
Yeah.
So that's what's troubling about the patent law right now is it's kind of like if you thought of something and you wrote it down first, you win mm-hmm. because it's unique. And I just think that too many things are unique right now.
So though I am excited about Apple taking what may be a legitimate hit, do you think they should be hit for this thing? Or
I don't know enough about the patent to say whether they should or not. I think that if the University of Wisconsin has put a lot of research in it and they show – what I think should happen is when you show that you've done a lot of work in an area and you've invested in that, that should be you should be rewarded for doing that kind of thing.
You should get the credit at the very least.
Well, yeah, but you should even like if I put down and just spend a lot of time on how to make great veneer wood, mm-hmm. then at some point in time, if I figure out a new pattern and I've shown that because of my hard work, I should be rewarded for a shortened period of time to share that knowledge with everybody, so everybody can use this great new way of veneering wood, mm-hmm. And then I should get some benefit from it, so other people will do the same type of work.
There was a time when public universities did not patent their wares so aggressively, and it was considered a public good to promote the useful arts and sciences by having an academic environment. But that's a discussion for another day.
Yeah, it is, in fact, a discussion for another day. Well, I'm fascinated by this whole subject because, as you say, on the one hand, what about the public good? And then what about the need to profit? And when those former institutions of here, just take it, public good are having trouble themselves getting funded, then they got to grab every funding stream they can.
And $860 million going to a university could probably be a good thing for people.
Yeah, would they create an Apple building?
That would be hilarious.
That would be funny.
This endowment.
This endowment. Oh, that's insane. Why wouldn't we leave it on that sort of happy, insane note?
Sounds good.
Yeah, okay. So thanks for listening to GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So we say use our stuff any way you like. But, you know, come on, man. Cite your sources. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit us at GeekSpeak.org or email us at geeks@geekspeak.org or contact us on Twitter or at KUSPGeeks. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Reverend Bonnie Jean Primsch. I also do weddings. With Lyle Troxell, Brian Young, and Miles Elam. GeekSpeak is produced by Lyle Troxell. Thanks to our intern, Chandler, our Canadian correspondent, Greg Merkley. And thank you for being here for our October 24th, 2015 episode of GeekSpeak.